This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Remember the Arab Spring? This was a series of uprisings in nations across the Arab world that started 5 years ago. As America contemplates electing a new presidential administration, it's important to assess the results of the current administration's policies, especially since one of the two main candidates was Secretary of State at the time of the Arab Spring. We're going to talk with Trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about the outcome of those revolutions. The Movement for Black Lives, this is an organization that is picking up the mantle of the Black Lives Matter movement. It has issued a massive statement describing its demands, its policy prescriptions and recommendations that are intended to solve the problems surrounding race relations in America. We're going to talk about this document with Trumpet writers Kieran Underwood and Andrew Miller. I really think it's important that all our listeners be aware of just how radical this statement of beliefs is to get an idea of where it is leading this nation. When families decline, governments rise. The less people depend on family for their economic security, the more they have to depend on the government to provide for their needs. And a lot of governments, like the U.S. today, are very happy to step in and to make more and more people dependent on them. We're going to talk with Andrew Miller about this remarkable trend and its ideological roots and some of its devastating effects. And we'll conclude the program today by talking about the different effects of socialist government compared to God's government. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. At the Democratic National Convention, President Obama said there has never been someone more qualified to be president than Hillary Clinton, his former Secretary of State. Well, one of the most significant developments in the world while she was in that office was the Arab Spring. This was a series of uprisings throughout the Middle East that started about 5 years ago. And at the time, a lot of people celebrated what was happening here. They thought it could lead to greater freedom and progress in these nations, including Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, Syria, Bahrain, and others in the Middle East. Well, 5 years down the road, we can see how much events in that Arab Spring played out, whether it really benefited the millions of people in these nations. I have Trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques here. Hello, Jeremiah.
Hi, great to be with you.
I want to thank you, first of all, for filling in for me the last two Fridays for the Week in Review.
Yeah, it was a real pleasure.
Enjoyable programs to listen to on the road. So let's start by talking about just how optimistic the American leaders were when this was happening, including the Secretary of State at the time.
Okay, sure. Yeah, I think the first big statement that came out was in May of 2011. And that was, you know, shortly after these revolutions had started sweeping through the area. And President Obama at that time delivered some remarks. I'll just quote a little bit from a speech that he gave. He said, "We have witnessed an extraordinary change taking place in the Middle East and North Africa. There must be no doubt that the United States of America welcomes change that advances self-determination and opportunity. Yes, there will be perils that accompany this moment of promise, but after decades of accepting the world as it is in the region, we have a chance to pursue the world as it should be."
That's a pretty good encapsulation of the kind of optimism that was sweeping the United States especially, but really a lot of Western capitals, it seems, in light of what was happening.
That's exactly right. Everyone was just brimming with optimism and hope about what might come after Mubarak in Egypt and after Gaddafi in Libya and after the other established governments in those nations. And here's another statement. This is from October of that same year, 2011, and this is from Hillary Clinton, who at that time was the U.S. Secretary of State. "On behalf of the American people and government, our congratulations, our best wishes to the Libyan people for what through great hardship, sacrifice, and courage they have achieved in opening the door to a more promising future for Libya after 42 years of Gaddafi dictatorship.
It's pretty remarkable to hear that in light of what happened soon after that in Benghazi and the chaos that has followed.
Yes. That was just shortly after Tripoli, the Libyan capital, had been surrounded and really infiltrated by various rebel groups. And she was just overjoyed to see that Gaddafi was on the cusp of overthrow. And, you know, as you could hear in those comments, she was just entirely optimistic, apparently, about the bright future that was sure to bring in for the people of Libya.
Well, let's just kind of start breaking it down. When we look at country by country, what has actually taken place in that region? Tunisia was really where it started.
It was, yeah. Tunisia, on December 17th of 2010, really the whole spark that ignited the Arab Spring was ignited there. That happened when a street vendor, a man named Mohamed Bouazizi, set fire to himself, and it was to protest unemployment and to protest police harassment. It had happened just after authorities had confiscated his fruit stand, which was his livelihood, and it ended up erupting into these full-scale protests there in Libya, which of course later, which later, spread into all those other nations. But in Tunisia, those protests very soon forced the dictator, Zine El Abidine Ben Ali, who had been in power for about 25 years, to step down. And in the aftermath of that, Tunisia suffered all kinds of terrorism and ongoing human rights abuses. The tourism industry is suffering terribly too. It is worth noting that despite all this instability, Tunisia has recently experienced its first free elections. And so some analysts do consider Tunisia to be sort of the only relatively successful story of the Arab Spring. But in my view, that really requires a pretty loose definition of successful.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about Libya.
Okay, yes. February of 2011, shortly after everything in Tunisia there, the Libyans began marching in the streets of Tripoli and other cities demanding the ouster of Muammar Gaddafi and his regime. Gaddafi had been in power for 42 years, and so he responded to all this with a violent crackdown. And the United Nations Security Council had been working with Gaddafi for decades, as had the U.S., because even though he certainly was a dictator, he stabilized that nation, and he was able to keep it relatively peaceful, relatively cooperative with the international community in many ways. But in 2011, the U.N. and the U.S. turned on him and authorized airstrikes against his forces. So after about 6 months and after thousands of deaths, those UN-backed rebels took the capital. They took Tripoli, and Gaddafi fled, but he was captured a few days later and really barbarically killed. And it didn't take long for Libya to just collapse into total chaos. All governments that have attempted to stabilize it since then have been just torn asunder by rebel groups, by foreign interventions, by these various militias, some of which fly the banner of Al-Qaeda or the Islamic State. And in many cases, these are just the most barbaric and radical terrorists on the planet. And since that revolution began, some 500,000 Libyans have fled the country, 430,000 are displaced within Libya, and 2.5 million are in need of humanitarian assistance. So it's much darker, much more chaotic than it ever was under Gaddafi.
So you mentioned these folks who were displaced. I think that's probably a good way to transition into Syria. What happened in Syria in 2011, and then what has happened since?
Yes, well, the Syrians were inspired to see those uprisings in Tunisia and in Egypt and Libya. So in March of 2011, they started protesting against Bashar Assad. Within about 4 months, the conflict had escalated into a full civil war. And from there, Syria quickly became kind of a proxy war. On one side, you had Russia and Iran backing Assad. On the other side, you have Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Qatar and others backing those rebel forces, even the U.S. in some cases. So since that conflict began, dozens of belligerent groups have entered into the fray, including most notably the Islamic State. The Islamic State really took advantage of the chaos in Syria, and they separated themselves from Al-Qaeda and soon declared rule over huge areas, which they now in those areas, they routinely carry out the most savage imaginable carnage in those places they control. If you just look at the numbers for Syria, it's really heartbreaking. But since the uprisings began, about 250,000 people have been killed, 65,000 more are missing, and half of the nation's population, which is 11 million people, have been displaced.
Crazy.
So it's it's the worst refugee crisis since the end of World War II. You know, it has resulted in 4.5 million people leaving Syria altogether, and the rest of those displaced of that 11 million are displaced within Syria.
And of course, that's created problems far-reaching, far beyond Syria. All of these people streaming out of that country have changed the situation in Turkey, in Germany, and throughout Europe. And I mean, this is really the source of the greatest portion of those migrants that we're talking about that have created this crisis throughout Europe.
That's right. It's sending ripple effects all over the world, really, with this refugee crisis. And if you look at the people, the Syrians who are still in Syria, it's also, 44% inflation rates every year, negative GDP growth rates, stratospheric unemployment. I mean, it's just utter carnage in that country for those people that are still living there. So you can see why so many of them are trying to find greener pastures elsewhere.
Well, just very briefly, maybe you can talk about Egypt, Bahrain, Yemen, some of these other nations that that experienced a lot of turmoil and that same kind of spirit of promise and optimism during those days of the Arab Spring.
Yeah, in Egypt, it was sort of a parallel situation to what we saw in Libya in some ways. It was a strong man. He was a dictator, Hosni Mubarak, but he was one who was cooperative in many ways with Western powers. He stabilized the nation. He suppressed the more radical elements of the population there. But then we turned on him. And so Mubarak had been targeted by weeks of violent protests, and he had been abandoned by the United States and other Western allies. So he stepped down. He resigned.
So in the time since then, we've had two revolutions.
Yeah, that's right. After he stepped down, Egypt's voters catapulted the leader of the Muslim Brotherhood's political wing into power, a man named Mohamed Morsi. But then Morsi unveiled these constitutional changes that granted himself pretty much unlimited power, so he didn't last long. And at that point, the military took over again, cracked down on the Muslim Brotherhood, and then brought in Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, who is now the president. And that's where we are today. Under Sisi, Egypt is again under military rule, and it faces a more repressive atmosphere than any time during the Mubarak regime.
There's also a lot of people that are angling to try to get him out of power as well.
That's right. So there's a really violent set of undercurrents, I think, in Egypt that would love to see him toppled. And so it's only with a really strong hand, I believe, that he's able to keep the Muslim Brotherhood and other factions like that sort of suppressed.
Yemen is another country that really kind of fell to pieces, and Iran kind of swooped in and was able to take advantage of the chaos that happened in that country post Arab Spring. Bahrain, a similar situation where you have a strong dictator who's kind of taken the mantle from those that tried to free the nation from the problems before. This is a pretty consistent picture of things actually getting worse than they were at the time that the Arab Spring took place. You mentioned in Syria how the Islamic State was able to kind of step in and, they really came into being post-Arab Spring. It was really probably the Arab Spring that and the chaos that ensued that paved the way for them to be able to come to power.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think many analysts would say that the Islamic State was born of the Arab Spring. They just took advantage of all that chaos in Syria and in Iraq to a degree, and took the chance to break away from Al-Qaeda, I think it was, and now they're more savage and more powerful in some areas than any terrorist group we've seen in recent memory, at least.
So just, we don't have a whole lot of time, but just thinking of the conclusions that we can draw from surveying this landscape of the Arab Spring 5 years later, first of all, in terms of what this tells us about America's foreign policy, this shows just how nearsighted American leaders can be in assessing a situation like this, and just how even the best, most hopeful scenarios that they might concoct can just blow up in our faces. But looking at the Middle East specifically, what are some of the prophetic, biblical prophetic implications of some of these developments?
Well, I would say mostly it's just that these revolutions have, on the whole, destabilized the region. It's bred chaos of all kinds. Sectarian divides are running deeper every year. Desperation and turbulence abound. You've got youth unemployment rates above 25% in some countries. So if you just think about what that means, it's hundreds and thousands of young men harboring really radical Islamist ideologies who don't have jobs and who are hungry and they don't have much to do to occupy their time in any productive way. And what all of that adds up to is just a lot of chaos, which can and is being in some ways already harnessed by Iran. I think we see Iran's proxy power growing in Syria. We see Iran taking advantage of the chaos in Yemen through its proxy groups there. And so it just, all this instability and all this turbulence, I believe, is prophetically significant because it does swing the door wide open for the mullahs in Tehran to just expand their own power.
It seems like you also see effects in, as that unfolds, as the Islamic State's power grows and Iran kind of uses that to its own advantage, you see a country like Saudi Arabia getting more desperate. It's threatening to develop nuclear technology and that kind of thing, where that instability is leading to stronger, more desperate measures being taken by some of these other nations. And how that plays out exactly, in a way, the jury is still out just how much damage the Arab Spring will cause. But looking at it from a prophetic standpoint, it seems like you could see a number of these major prophecies that we follow being accelerated and fulfilled as a direct result of some of the support that Western nations gave to these revolutions in these countries. Very interesting to look at. We've been talking with trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques. He actually put together a spread on this subject in the August edition of the Trumpet magazine. It's called The Arab Spring, 5 Years On. You can find that online at thetrumpet.com if you look for the August edition of the Trumpet on the website there. Thanks for your time, Jeremiah.
Great to be with you.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Race relations in America today are extremely tense after highly publicized killings of blacks by white police officers and then the premeditated murder of police officers by black shooters in Dallas, Baton Rouge, and elsewhere. Well, a group called the Movement for Black Lives has just weighed in on this matter. It comprises 50 organizations across the United States. It seems to be officially articulating the Black Lives Matter ideology. On August 1st, this group released a written statement explaining its demands and its policy recommendations for the United States. I want to talk about this with trumpet writers Kieran Underwood and Andrew Miller. Hello, gentlemen.
Great to be here.
Hello.
Hey, nice job on the show last week, Mr. Underwood. It was good to have you there. I got to hear you while I was traveling on the road, the Week in Review last week. I'm going to start by, well, first of all, let's just talk about this organization. We've been seeing the hashtag Black Lives Matter since it blew up on social media in 2013 after the Trayvon Martin shooting. This group is essentially taking that and the energy behind the Black Lives Matter movement, which is really kind of a decentralized grassroots kind of revolution, and articulating something more official to give some legitimacy to that Black Lives Matter movement. Can you kind of explain maybe how this group is appropriating that?
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. This really was an effort to pull the resources that they would have around the nation. They grabbed 50 organizations led by black activists to create this a policy demand statement. It was called A Vision for Black Lives, Policy Demands for Black Power, Freedom, and Justice. So in that paper, that they outlined six major demands, and among those were roughly around 40 policy recommendations for the government in local, state, and federal.
So if you Google Black Lives Matter platform, this is the first thing that comes up on Google. I'm wondering, you know, President Obama has had some of the Black Lives Matter leaders, those who were initially behind that, invited them to the White House and expressed public support for that movement to some degree. How much can we equate Black Lives Matter, that decentralized social movement, with these activists and what they're articulating here? Do either of you have an idea?
It's definitely this movement's the most organized of the Black Lives Matter movement. Like you said, it is, anyone can use the hashtag. There's not like a copyright or something on it. It's I've probably used it in my Twitter account a couple times myself, but it's
full disclosure,
right? So we go full disclosure there, but because it is decentralized, it is hard to get an official ideology. But with this one, where you have like up to 50 chapters in 50 major cities, it definitely speaks for a lot of people. So it's going to be as close as you're going to get to a party line coming out of the Black Lives Matter movement.
Well, you can see the website that they've created. It's policy.m4bl.org. M4b, for the number, Movement for Black Lives is what that stands for. But I'm just going to read the first paragraph of the platform that they've written here. Black humanity and dignity requires black political will and power. Despite constant exploitation and perpetual oppression, black people have bravely and brilliantly been the driving force pushing the U.S. toward the ideals it articulates but has never achieved. In recent years, we've taken to the streets, launched massive campaigns, and impacted elections, but our elected leaders have failed to address the legitimate demands of our movement. We can no longer wait. So let's get into some of the details of what they are proposing. The section on this website about demands. First of all, it says end the war on black people. What are their demands with respect to that, Kieran?
They come out with a number of claims initially that there is a definite war going on against black people in the country. Some of the things that they bring out, criminalization and dehumanization of black youth in all sectors. Some of the demands they have is to end those types of things, end capital punishment, end money bail, and a number of different things.
That where they're looking at disparate racial outcomes, or they're looking at the number of, say, criminals who are executed being disproportionately black. Therefore, the solution is to eliminate the death penalty.
Yeah, all these things which really affect everyone in the country. but
or that a lot of people would look at and say, well, they disproportionately affect criminals.
Right.
Or they disproportionately affect violent criminals. And so you could look at that one in one sense and see this as being a necessary prevention of criminal activity, but they're looking at everything through the lens of racism.
Yes. And I think what's interesting is if you look at the history, maybe the last 100 years of American history, black crime rates have actually gone down proportionately compared to whites. So in the 1940s and 1950s, even before World War II, the rates were nearly 17, 18, sometimes 20 to 1. And now it is actually decreased for what that's worth. It is actually less proportionately than it used to be.
We actually have an infographic in the September issue of The Trumpet that shows the amount of crime committed by whites or non-blacks relative to blacks and the amount of people who have been shot. I mean, they're kind of basing a lot of this on the claim that there's this kind of genocide happening on the part of police officers against black youths, black men in particular. But the numbers don't bear that out.
Right. That's the main point of that infographic, that it is true that blacks are arrested at twice the rate that whites are for committing crimes. But then if you adjust for the arrest rate, once a police arrest someone, they're actually more likely to shoot them if they're not black. They're actually more careful with the blacks they arrest than they are with other races. And so if there's any discrepancy in the shooting rate, it's due to the fact that they're being arrested more.
So they say to end the war on black people, it would be important to eliminate drug offenses or to legalize drugs, to legalize prostitution. What are some of the demands that they're...
That actually comes under a different set of demands. I think that comes under the community control of the laws. That's the fifth one. But they have different things here about ending mass surveillance of black communities. I didn't realize that was happening. I think that would happen to communities, whether they're black or white, if it is happening. The demilitarization of law enforcement. Immediate end to the privatization of police, prisons, jails, probation. I mean, these are not minor changes.
Mm-hmm. So they're looking for increasing federalization of these, prisons and that type of thing?
As local as possible. They would like
so it. Local government, but not private citizens.
Exactly right. So controlled by the people who are being affected by it.
Okay, so the second area they say is reparations. They're demanding reparations.
Yeah, the official sentence is, or the demand is, we demand reparations for past and continuing harms. That would be reparations in terms of having high-quality educational opportunities and full and free access to just black people, it says in here. A guaranteed minimal livable income, which is something that we see in Europe being debated right now, universal basic income.
And Canada, we had talked about that previously.
Yes, and reparations for wealth extracted from our communities through what they call environmental racism, slavery, food apartheid.
Food apartheid.
These things that I didn't know, I actually didn't know that environmental racism existed. I had to think about what that would actually be. But these things would be repaired by giving more access to the black people than to anyone else. So exclusive benefits.
And then another area of demands, invest and divest. What are they referring to there?
Investing in education and health and safety and taking it away from what they call exploitative forces, which are prisons, police, surveillance. So taking it away from policing and putting it into education. Now, there's nothing wrong with putting money into education, but we already have millions and millions of dollars. It really has nothing to do with the money, a bit more about the method. But this is where they get into de-investing in police funding. This is where it has the retroactive decriminalization, immediate release, and record expungement of all drug-related offenses and prostitution. So pretty much if you have a drug crime or you're a pimp, that's now not going to be on your record. You should be released from jail. That is something that not even the Democratic Party would think about, those kind of things. But that's the platform that they're on.
Yeah, like I said, the surprising part to me actually is just how similar, when you look at both these two lists of demands together, they are to the 10-point plan of the Black Panthers in the 1960s. I pulled that up. Actually, I went to Marxist.org. The Black Panthers, the original Black Panthers, being a Marxist group, they've got like some of the founding documents of Marxist movements on that website. So I was able to print it off. But they're amongst their demands were a government guaranteed right to full employment, an end to capitalist oppression, the immediate end to police brutality, an immediate end to immediate releasing of all blacks in prisons. And it's basically the first 9 points are demanding a socialist government in the United States. And then the 10th point is that if you don't give us this, we want our own state. Give us 5 states in the Southwest United States to have our own like black nationalist nation.
Hmm. So just going back to the other categories of demands, they have economic justice listed here. You were just talking, Andrew, about a move toward a more socialistic kind of economy. What sort of demands specifically are they looking for here, Kieran?
The first one they have on the list of their policy demands is to restructure the tax code, restructure a progressive tax code that we have at the state and local level and federal level to ensure radical and sustainable redistribution of wealth. Among other things, there's plenty of these things look directly like socialism. But when you look at the American tax rate right now, it's already progressive. So the idea that we should restructure it to make it progressive is ludicrous because it's already progressive. If you earn over the 100,000, whatever the number is, the tax rate is definitely higher than if you're earning 20,000, 30,000. So we already have a progressive tax rate.
So the final demand category is political power. What are some of their specific policy recommendations in that respect?
The first one they have is an end to the criminalization of black political activity, release of political prisoners, full access to the right to vote, which we already have. It seems surprising that we're still talking about this, but they seem to claim that people on the right are doing everything to make sure that people cannot vote.
This is probably talking about policies like the demand that people present identification for voting and those types of policies.
Yes, exactly right. Because because the proportion of black people or poor people who can supply those kind of things at will is apparently less. So I guess that's what they're trying to say is a restriction on voting.
So they've really mapped out. You said you printed the entire policy, all of their policy recommendations. It ended up being something like a 70-page document in a Word, Microsoft Word file. This is a huge number of demands. And are they giving any kind of indication of fulfill this or else? What are the consequences if these policies are not implemented?
They have to be careful in what they say. Obviously, they can't directly say we are going to start a war. But they do make all kinds of statements saying that this has to stop and we will take to the streets if this doesn't happen.
So there's no specific threats of force or that type of thing. If they're saying take to the streets, this is still presumably, ostensibly, a peaceful protest.
Yeah, most of the comments that you'll hear, which are explicitly violent, are not going to come from the leaders. They're going to come from people who have been inspired, and then who go out by themselves and take that action into their own hands.
Well, we have a major story by our editor-in-chief in the coming edition of the Trumpet called America Faces an Explosion of Racial Violence. This was actually the top story on the website, thetrumpet.com, yesterday, really just drawing attention to how much this is escalating as we see these the attacks on police, direct attacks on police that are taking place in more and more cities in America today. A lot of effort that is being used to undermine, and this policy recommendation by this group shows just how much they are seeking to undermine the power of law enforcement within the United States today. It'll be interesting to see, I think, just to watch this now that they've kind of laid down the gauntlet and said this is what we stand for, how mainstream is this going to be? I think the Black Lives Matter hashtag, just as a social media tool, has been something that has pulled a lot of people in that probably had a lot of disparate ideas. They've really said, now, this is what we believe. You know, do with it what you will. How is the president going to respond? To my knowledge, he hasn't said anything about this since they released it on August 1st. Is that right?
From what I can tell.
So, yeah, just what is he going to do? How is this, you know, how mainstream is this going to be? How much are these ideals that they've articulated going to be insisted on? What are the consequences of a failure to implement these policies? There's just a whole lot of questions. But you put it in the context of everything that our editor-in-chief has been saying, that biblical prophecy says about the increase in race-related violence in the United States, and it's not difficult at all to see how this could lead to some pretty explosive times ahead. So definitely something that we need to keep our eyes on. Well, we appreciate you guys talking about this with us, and thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
There has been a dramatic power shift in Western society over the past couple of generations, a shift away from the family and toward the government. Across the Western world, people are giving up on traditional family life and looking more and more to government agencies to provide for their economic needs. This is a massive change. It has a lot of dramatic effects. It's also a trend with some very intriguing historical associations. And to talk about it, I've kept Andrew Miller behind from the last interview. Let's just talk first of all about some of the numbers that show this shift from family to government.
Right. Well, the Heritage Center does a dependency index, and then there are several other centers that also kind of keep track of government dependency. And just within the past decade or so, we crossed a line where actually it's about half of people in the United States are receiving some sort of government aid, whether that's Social Security or Medicare or Medicaid or food stamps or housing supplements. In some way, they're dependent on the government for their weekly for their annual income, and which is quite a shocking statistic to think about. I was trying to think, like, so what did people do before they had these programs? And I know if you listen to someone like Senator Bernie Sanders, he'll tell you that they just starved in the streets before they had this, even though I've never able to find one source that would give me the name of even one person who's ever starved in America. Maybe one exists, but I've certainly never found any record of it. But I know I was talking to a friend of mine who's in their 90s, Mr. Robert Turgeon, the other day, and he was telling me stories about his experiences in the Great Depression, and saying this. I said, "Well, I said before the 1935, there weren't any government programs like they have today. People relied on their family if they were down on their luck, and which that really shows why you'd have to have so many government programs today. Is obviously we've had infographics and articles and the Trumpet before, just showing that 2-3 generations ago, like 80% of adults were married to someone of the opposite sex with children and had a strong family structure with aunts and uncles and grandparents. And now the marriage rate has dipped below 50%, and you're seeing this rise of like elderly, what they call the elderly orphans. That's people who maybe were single children to begin with a generation ago, and then they focused on their careers and never married, so they don't have children or brothers, and now they're getting to a point where they can't provide for themselves anymore because they're old, and if they don't have a large savings account, you really almost have no choice but to rely on the government.
Well, this is an interesting question, because you were talking on the Week in Review program last week about this study that came out that showed how welfare programs tend to suppress marriage rates. And I think you could easily look at this as a kind of a chicken and egg scenario. How much is it that the decline of the family has necessitated or at least provoked or inspired more government programs to exist in order to catch those who maybe fell through the safety net? And how much has the increase in government welfare provision suppressed and contributed to the decline of the family?
Right. It does seem kind of like a chicken and egg scenario. And it is actually probably more described, I guess, in, if you use like an analogy from like the biological sciences, they kind of call that a negative feedback loop, where it's kind of both just going round and round and round in circles, to where you had the sexual revolution take off in the 1960s. I mean, divorce rates went through the roof. You started having people who families were breaking apart, so they didn't have a family structure. So the government stepped in to provide the need. And then when the government stepped in to provide the need, people started realizing that they didn't need to get married or keep their family together for economic security. They could rely on the government. So then the marriage rates went further low. And then so the government stepped in more, and then the marriage rates went further down. And it just kept spiraling and spiraling until 60 years later. I mean, the family is about halfway down the path to extinction.
There's a perverse element in this equation, and that is the fact that when the government encourages people to get onto welfare, I think there's a lot of evidence to show that there is a lot of self-interest on the part of those politicians who are doing that, because they're securing votes for their party or for themselves for future for some time to come, you know. So they're looking after themselves, and they're not really paying as much attention to the social consequences of those welfare programs.
Right. Yeah, there is definitely an argument to be made of if you were like a very cynical politician, the fact that if people are voting for you because you're providing their economic needs, and you, as a politician, your job is to get more people to vote for you. If you provide the economic needs for more people, that keeps you in power. But no, because it is interesting is that I think a lot of the politicians today probably have good intentions as to just trying to help people who don't have families and not, are, like you said, aren't really thinking about some of the social consequences of this. But if you go back 100 years, I mean, this... there definitely was a very concentrated movement that, you know, the family needs to be destroyed on purpose.
Okay, well, let's talk about some of these historical, the thinkers in the past who have supported this idea and this shift away from the concentration of power within the family. And we could look at it as economic power, maybe in the most basic sense. And shifting that into government hands.
Well, of course, the two most famous philosophers advocating that there needed to be perfect income equality in the world were Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, the inventors of communism, the co-authors of the Communist Manifesto. And if you read the Communist Manifesto, or even more so Engels' book on the origin of the family, he really makes the case that he said, well, income inequality exists because some people are born rich and some people are born poor. Therefore, the only way we'll ever get rid of it is if people don't pass on their wealth to their children. Mm-hmm. And he said, no, that's hard to do because there's a genetic urge to pass on your wealth to their children, make sure they succeed. He said, so in the best case to do that is you need your children to be educated by the state. You need private property to be abolished, and you need both men and women in the workforce. He said, if you're a housewife, then you're reliant on your husband's income. You're not economically equal to him. So he's like, says, and that is basically one of like the 10 planks of the Communist Manifesto. As I can't remember all 10 right now, but one of them is like, you need both sexes in the workforce. You need no private property, so you can't pass on wealth to your children. And children need to be educated by the state, not their parents.
To me, this is the aspect of the Communist Manifesto that most clearly exposes just how ungodly, how anti-biblical, how anti-God the communist system is. That they feel like basically the family is a threat to the power of the state. And they're using income equality to justify it. But essentially, they're abolishing the most basic unit that was established in the Bible as the means of encouraging people to take responsibility for themselves and to grow in character and to, you know, to make life worth living and right. to understand God and his plan and everything about him. It's all about the family. They're about exactly the opposite.
Right. Again, they definitely, I even have seen some other communist writers who they've compared the family to the molecule of the capitalist economic system. Hmm. He said it's basically like the smallest economic or even government. Smallest economic and government unit is the family. So if you don't want separate units within society, if you just want one big overarching equal society, you need to basically melt those molecules into one. It's like competition. I mean, anyone who's every society has people who need education or who need care. They're too young or they're too old or they're too sick to take care of themselves. Traditionally, families took care of those people. If you want a society of complete income equality where the government takes care of those people, that's your main competitor is the family. And it got even quite a bit more extreme after Marx and Engels. Marx and Engels, they weren't necessarily against the idea of a monogamous marriage as long as the two people who were married were free to get divorced at any time they wanted to and didn't take care of their children and both worked.
Right. Which is, well, I mean, really, there's a lot of statements in the Communist Manifesto that show that any coercion or any power that parents would have over their own children is destructive to the power of the state. And so we have to eliminate that. And even like you mentioned earlier, the idea of one spouse having a certain amount of power over another spouse, they considered that anathema to their
right. They write all the time about oppression and coercion and the authoritarianism of the family, and it's not necessarily that they're opposed to oppression or coercion or authoritarianism. They're just mad that
they don't want anyone else.
They're just
to have
mad
it
that it's not them who's yeah. doing it. But
so, well, just looking at this historically, if we can do this quickly, what happened to the family, say, in under Soviet rule in Russia?
Right. Well, Lenin did all those enactments that he did. That Marx recommended. He decriminalized homosexuality. He legalized no-fault divorce. He legalized abortion. And within about 10 years, he had about 7 million children orphaned, no one to take care of them that he couldn't feed. He didn't have the money. He would increase tax rates if he could, but he was already at 100%. So, and so they did eventually in the 1940s backtrack on some of those things, and they just said, it's like, well, just feed your kids and teach them to be good communists because we don't have the money to do it. And so you'd start seeing kind of a backpedaling from some of these ideas of Marx and Engels in Russia and China. But in the United States, it started taking off at about the same time. You had people like William Reich, who was, they call him the father of the sexual revolution. And he, I won't even talk about some of the experiments he did because they're weird. But philosophy-wise, he actually written a book that said that when the Soviets recriminalized homosexuality, he predicted, even somewhat prophetically, that that would be the end of their revolution. He said, you're allowing the family to exist. He said, eventually it'll reassert itself and your system will come crumbling down. He was one of the main philosophers that are thinking that Marx and Engels got the cart before the horse. See, Marx and Engels said, if we abolish private property, there won't be any need for the family because the family only exists to give stuff to your kids. If you can't give stuff to your kids, the family will wither away on its own. He was saying, I agree with their goal, but they've got the order wrong. You have to destroy the family first. But more or less what I was describing earlier is that if you destroy the family first, now you've got all these elderly people or children who have no one to provide for them. They're forced to rely on the state. No backseas. It doesn't care if you have an economic crisis. If the family is gone, you can't do like Soviet Russia did. It's like, oh, well, this turned out to be a disaster. Let's go back to the old way. You can't do the old way. It doesn't exist anymore.
Mm. Yeah, that's phenomenal. When you're looking at those specific policy prescriptions that you're describing, even the introduction of something like Social Security, where rather than being a part of a family economically and the interdependence that would be created multi-generationally, rather than having that, transferring that dependence onto the state for retirement funds and so on, it seems like they've pretty much gone down the list to find every conceivable way of fracturing those dependencies that happen within the family.
And in the 50s and 60s, there definitely was a movement to do this on purpose. Like I mentioned, Wilhard Reich, Herbert Marcuse, these were founding fathers of what I guess they called the New Left movement. They called themselves the New Left because they were different from the Old Left. The Old Left was like Marx and Engels. They wanted to nationalize the economy first and then let the family wither away. The New Left's like, no, that's the wrong order. We need to destroy the family and then the economy will nationalize itself. A lot of even the primary leaders in politics today, they were students during that hippie New Left movement. Now, back in the 60s, I think most of those student radicals, they were actually reading Reich and Marx and Marcuse, and they had a better sense of what this was all about. Today, I don't think most of the political advocates who advocate these policies are quite as well-read as their forebears, so they may not know that what these policies they're advocating were designed to do. But whether you know what they were for or not doesn't matter. They still work exactly like they were designed.
Right. And if you just step back and you look at the effects, then you have to acknowledge that this transfer of power from family to government, that this is taking place on a massive scale, and it's
right
to the detriment of society.
Yeah, the sexual revolution and the welfare state were both designed by people who knew that the family had to be undermined as the basic economic building blocks of society. Now, over the past 6 years, a lot of their successors might just be operating on autopilot. But
although
you
it
definitely
is interesting,
can see
there
that
are some people who are stating those things quite outright, and you hear right. some of the advocates of, say, same-sex marriage, homosexual rights, and so on, they're talking about the abolition of the traditional family. Some of them are even talking about the fact that the idea that we're introducing same-sex marriage, that it's kind of a stepping stone to a world where it wouldn't exist at all.
Right, and because I think Wilhard Reich and Herbert Marcuse both were very big supporters of the homosexual movement because, see, a homosexual relationship, biologically, it can't produce children. And socially, there's no gender roles because they're the same gender. And so there's no economic function to a homosexual marriage like there is to a heterosexual marriage. And that's the exact type of relation that Marx and Engels were advocating that men and women have with each other. He said, I don't care if you marry another man or if you marry a woman, just as long as economically, socially, psychologically, you are equal and the same in every way.
We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller. He's working on an article on this subject for the October edition of the Trumpet magazine. It's called The Nationalization of the Family. You can watch for that in the time ahead on thetrumpet.com. In the meantime, you might be interested in checking out Redefining Family. This is a book that we have on our website. If you go to thetrumpet.com, you can look for that under the literature tab. That talks about some of these issues and just show how dramatically the family has been restructured just over the last couple of generations. Fascinating subject, Andrew. I'm looking forward to seeing the finished product there of your efforts.
All right, yeah, thanks for having me on the show.
It's time for today's last word.
Some people believe that the Bible advocates socialism as an economic model. Trumpet writer Robert Morley wrote about this in our July edition of The Trumpet in an article called Is God a Socialist? You can read that on thetrumpet.com if you look for it there. But that conversation with Andrew Miller on the expansion of government just makes me think about the effects that socialist government has on people, and what an outstanding proof it is that it is not God's form of government. Those kinds of fruits manifest just how anti-God, how ungodly that form of government is. If you study the Bible, you see an altogether different form of government, and it's a form of government that has far more beautiful effects, wonderful effects. And I want to just quickly list a few of the stark differences that exist between the socialist model that you see in a lot of nations today, more and more you see it in the United States, and the perfect model of government expounded in Scripture. Socialist government creates complacency through wealth redistribution. God's government, on the other hand, fosters stewardship through private property ownership. Socialist government takes from the rich to supply the poor, and it calls that compassion. God's government teaches love by example, and it inspires both rich and poor to emulate that example of their own free will. Socialist government encourages dependency. God's government encourages industry. Socialist government creates discontent and a sense of entitlement. God's government enables man to savor the fruits of his own labor. Socialist government rewards idleness and it saps motivation. God's government energizes, it ennobles, and it arouses ambition. Socialist government tends towards self-satisfaction and mediocrity. God's government demands excellence. In fact, it inspires us to strive for perfection. Socialist government insulates man from the consequences of his actions. God's government obliges man to be accountable for his choices. Socialist government strips man of responsibility. God's government prepares man for ever greater capacity, duty, and authority. Socialist government erodes character. God's government is aimed primarily at creating and cultivating character. Socialist government turns citizens into wards of the state. God's government transforms people into gods. If you want to learn more about God's government, go online to thetrumpet.com, look under the literature tab, and download the booklet, God's Family Government. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Feel free to send your thoughts on the program today by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests on today's program, Jeremiah Jacques, Kieran Underwood, and Andrew Miller. Thanks also to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And I'll leave you with this thought from John Lubbock. Happiness is a thing to be practiced, like the violin. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.